You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. And Brian is our host tonight. He's joined by novelist... Yes, Brian? He's joined by novelist Nina Rivore, right here. The author of 5 novels, who for the past 2 decades has worked for an organization that helps children affected by violence and poverty in Central and South Los Angeles, and Melvin L. Rogers. Melvin is Associate Professor of African American Studies and Political Science at UCLA, and a scholar currently working on a project titled Democracy and Faith, Race and the Politics of Redemption in American Political Thought. I think, please, another round of applause. He deserves it. They all deserve it. I think most of us in this room will agree that tonight's program on James Baldwin could not be more timely for all kinds of reasons. We will take some questions from the audience towards the end of tonight's program, and we will be circulating a microphone, so please wait for it to come to you. And please make your question a question, would also be helpful. And now, please join me, and we'll turn it over in welcoming Brian to the program. Thank you.
Well, hello. I am Brian DeShazer, former director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States. And this is From the Vault, live from the Mark Taper Auditorium in the downtown Central Library, as part of the Los Angeles Library Foundation's Aloud series. From the Vault is broadcasting live for the first time since we began our series over 10 years ago. We are live on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, and 99.5 FM Ridgecrest. Yes, thank you. Hi, KPFK Los Angeles. Welcome, and welcome to the Central Library. It's also the first time we're recording live before an audience to be broadcast on over 35 Pacifica radio affiliate stations nationwide in places like KAOS, Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington, KPFT, Houston, Texas, and my favorite, WOMR in Provincetown or P-Town, Massachusetts. Tonight, we are very proud to bring you the words, wisdom, and the voice of the original James Baldwin. Let's bring James into the room with us with this opening excerpt from November 26th, 1962.
I really don't like words like artist or integrity or courage or nobility. I have a kind of distrust of all those words because I don't really know what those words mean. Any more than I really know what such words as democracy or peace or peace-loving or warlike or integration mean. And yet, one's compelled to recognize that all these imprecise words are kind of attempts made by us all to get to something which is real and which lives behind the word. Whether I like it or not, for example, and no matter what I call myself, I suppose the only word for me when the chips are down is that I am an artist. There is such a thing. There is such a thing as integrity. Some people are noble. There is such a thing as courage. The terrible thing is that all of these words are reality. Behind these words depend ultimately on what the human being meaning every single one of us, believe to be real. The terrible thing is that all these words, the reality behind them, depend on choices one has got to make forever and ever and ever, every day. I am not interested, really, in talking to you as an artist. It seems to me that the artist struggle for his integrity is a kind of metaphor, must be considered as a metaphor for the struggle which is universal and daily of all human beings on the face of this terrifying globe to get to become human beings. It is not your fault, and it is not my fault that I write. I would never become before you in the position of a complainant for doing something that I must do. What we might get at this evening, if we are lucky, if the mic doesn't fail, my voice holds out, if you ask me questions, is what the importance of this effort is. It would seem to me that, however arrogant this may sound, I want to suggest two propositions. The first one is that the poets, by which I mean all artists, are finally the only people who know the truth about us. Soldiers don't, statesmen don't, priests don't, union leaders don't. Only the poets. That's my first proposition. We know about the Oedipus complex not because of Freud, but because of a poet who lived in Greece thousands of years ago. And what he said then about what it was like to be alive is still true, in spite of the fact that now we can get to Greece in something like 5 hours, and then it would have taken I don't know how long a time.
That was the powerful voice of James Baldwin, speaking on November 26, 1962, from the Community Church in New York City, and recorded by Pacifica Station WBAI. Tonight on From the Vault, I share the stage with two distinguished guests to listen and help deepen the conversation about the impact James Baldwin has on contemporary society. I'm excited to give our guests the chance to respond to what we just heard. So first, we turn to our esteemed novelist, Nina Revor. Welcome to From the Vault.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here as part of the Aloud series. Great to be sharing the stage with you, Dr. Rogers. And obviously an honor to be speaking about James Baldwin, and thanks to all of you for being here today. And as Louise said, this could not be a more timely writer to be talking, more timely time to be discussing James Baldwin. I want to take just a second to describe and talk about why he means so much to me, why I'm here, before I address that clip. I'm an immigrant to this country. I was born in Japan. My mother is Japanese. My father is a white American. We moved to the rural Midwest when I was a child, where I faced tremendous racism for being half Japanese, for not speaking English, for being an immigrant. And then at some point, we then moved to California, where I grew up in a largely Latino and African American context. And I found very little, if any, writing, art, movies, very little representation or expression of the world as I knew it. Very few people who spoke to what I saw as reality. And so when I found James Baldwin's work, it was a revelation. And I grew up to become a writer, to write a lot about race, to write about community, to write about history. And there's simply been no writer that is more important to me, more formative to me, than James Baldwin. And I still look to him to help my own understanding of the world. and particularly in times like this last week and a half when there has been so much difficulty and turmoil. So that's what brings me here. That's what brings me to Mr. Baldwin.
Well, I'm so excited you're here.
Well, thank you. That's great.
That makes it all the better.
I want to speak to just the very last part of what he said in that clip, which I love so much. And again, it when he's talking about the poet, you know, only the poet, it strikes me that over the last week and a half, there has been a lot of sharing, a lot of conversation, a lot of communication, a lot of social media as well. And part of what's being shared, if you notice, is poems. You know, there's a Claudio Rankine poem that has been widely distributed. Nikki Giovanni, Jericho Brown, other poets. There's, of course, Miss James Baldwin himself, quotes from him. And it strikes me that in moments of great difficulty and great sorrow, that we do turn to the poet or to the artist to help distill and express that pain. And there's something to that. There's something to what he said. And it could be because, you know, he talks about the priest, he talks about the statesman, that people who describe news can tell us the what happened, the when it happened, but not necessarily the why or the how. Mm-hmm. And that when you hear someone, you know, a historian even describe an event that's hugely important, but an artist can tell you what it felt like. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so important that we turn to poets, to artists in a moment like this. And the other thing that strikes me is when he talks about integrity. And integrity can mean many, many different things, but one of the things that I think about is that having integrity as an artist is very lonely. Mm-hmm. It sometimes means saying things that are unpopular. It means speaking your truth. It means stepping outside of the expectations that even your greatest fans and admirers have of you. And that's something that James Baldwin was always able to do.
That's great. Thank you, Nina. Now we go to our UCLA professor, Dr. Melvin L. Rogers. Hey, Melvin, and welcome to From the Vault. I'm so glad you're here with us.
Thank you. I'm actually very delighted to be here. I'm quite honored. Very honored to share the couch with Nina.
You like our set.
You know, this is a very trying time for us to talk about Baldwin right now. I discovered Baldwin when I was a college student. And the first book that I read by Baldwin was The Fire Next Time. And it was for me, in many ways, an extraordinary ethical and political release. What's so extraordinary, I think, about Baldwin is that he is, in many ways, he represents a kind of moral light amid the sort of immoral darkness that seems to define both his age and our own. Right? And there's a way in which we can always go back to Baldwin, because through him, I think, we can sort of find a way to steady ourselves, to sort of help hold at bay the ways in which darkness is always threatening to encroach upon us. These clips, this clip in particular, I want to make two points about the clip. The first has to do with the principle of choice that is central to how he is thinking about the artist and all of you. And then the second point that I want to make is the way in which he uses the artist as an exemplar, right, for how we ought to think about what it is that we're doing in our everyday lives. So for the first point, one of the things that is interesting about what Baldwin says is that ethical ideas, integrity, courage, and nobility, these ideas are not, in fact, self-executing. That is to say, they don't simply unfold in front of you. And if it is the case that these ethical ideas do not simply unfold in front of you, the question then becomes, how is it that they find themselves in the world? Well, They find themselves in the world because you choose to be noble. You choose to be courageous. You choose to be just. And so if it is the case that we live in an ethical republic, it is only because of the choices that you and I have made. But if it is the case that we live in an unethical republic, as many of our Black counterparts, including myself, believe, that too is because of the choices we have made. And so the question that Baldwin always puts to us, right, is, who are you in the lives that you live and the practices in which you participate? The second point I would make is about the artist. In 1962, just actually a few months, I suppose, before he gave this speech, he wrote a shorter piece about the artist. And there, it was all about the artist. Now he says the artist is something like a metaphor for what it is we're doing. Right? And why is that the case? Well, the reason why is because the artist is always trying to resist the temptation to become complicit or complacent. Because let's be honest, the price of a peaceful society, the price that we often pay, often turns out to be complicity and complacency. And so what Baldwin tries to do is to use the artist as a kind of moral exemplar, with the hopes that you and I, at critical moments, will try to enact some of the practice of resistance that the artist represents.
Great, thank you. And I think that was fantastic. I'm so glad they're here to make me sound smarter, thank you, and to bring Baldwin into the conversation in the contemporary society. So actually, I want to talk real quick. We have just a little bit of time before we have to go to the next clip, of the difference between the written page and the sound of what we're hearing of Baldwin. For me, I don't know about y'all, but it's very emotional. I almost started crying in the middle of the last clip, and I've heard it like a million times. But tell me, what is your reaction, Nina, to hearing his voice instead of having the page in front of you?
It is very, I mean, he was an incredible orator. And being an incredible orator is art in itself. You know, and he had this background, of course, of having preached. And he brings all of the tools, the passion, the way that he uses silence and pauses in his speaking is tremendous. I felt like I was not just hearing him, but feeling him. And that is a tremendous and different experience. Reading him on the page is also a tremendous experience. This man could write the heck out of the sentence. Nobody writes sentences like James Baldwin, and it could start here and end up here, and were so remarkable and contain such a complexity of ideas within a single sentence, which was sometimes a paragraph long. The artistry, the magic, you know, the music, and the power there's just no bad way to experience James Baldwin.
I love the phrase "behind the word" in that last clip. And I want to acknowledge the Pacifica Radio Archives for preserving these recordings and being custodians of this history. And there's a lot of James Baldwin to discover at pacificaradioarchives.org. Well, now let's move on to Baldwin reading from his own 1956 novel, Giovanni's Room, which the Library of America says is a searching and in its day controversial treatment of the tragic self-delusions of a young American expatriate at war with his own homosexuality. Here is Baldwin from a 1963 recording.
I was proud, I think, because his head came just below my ear. We were walking along, and Joey was making dirty wisecracks, and we were laughing. Odd to remember, for the first time in so long, how good I felt that night, how fond of Joey. When we came back along those streets, it was quiet. We were quiet, too. We were very quiet in the apartment and sleepily got undressed in Joey's bedroom and went to bed. I fell asleep, for quite a while, I think. But I woke up to find the light on, and Joey examining the pillow with great ferocious care. What's the matter? I think a bed bug bit me. You slob. You got bed bug? I think one bit me. You ever have a bed bug bite you before? No. Well, go back to sleep. You're dreaming. He looked at me with his mouth open and his dark eyes very big. It was as though he had just discovered that I was an expert on bed bugs. I laughed and grabbed his head, as I had done God knows how many times before, when I was playing with him or when he had annoyed me. But this time, when I touched him, something happened in him and in me which made this touch different from any touch either of us had ever known. And he did not resist as he usually did, but lay where I had pulled him, against my chest. And I realized that my heart was beating in an awful way, and the joy was trembling against me, and the light in the room was very bright and hot. I started to move and to make some kind of joke. But Joey mumbled something, and I put my head down to hear. Joey raised his head as I lowered mine, and we kissed, as it were, by accident. Then, for the first time in my life, I was really aware of another person's body, of another person's smell. We had our arms around each other. It was like holding in my hand some rare, exhausted, nearly doomed bird which I had miraculously happened to find. I was very frightened. I am sure he was frightened too, and we shut our eyes to remember it so clearly, so painfully tonight. Tells me that I had never for an instant truly forgotten it. I feel in myself now a faint, dreadful stirring of what so overwhelmingly stirred in me then, a great thirsty heat and trembling and tenderness so painful I thought my heart would burst. But out of that astounding, intolerable pain came joy. We gave each other joy that night. It seemed then that a lifetime would not be long enough for me to act the joy, the act of love. But that lifetime was short. It was bounded by that night. It ended in the morning. I awoke while Joey was still sleeping, curled like a baby on his side toward me. He looked like a baby, his mouth half open, his cheek flushed, his curly hair darkening the pillow and half hiding his damp brown forehead, and his long eyelashes glinting slightly in the summer sun. We were both naked, and the sheet we had used as a cover was tangled around our feet. Joey's body was brown and was sweaty. The most beautiful creation I had ever seen till then. I would have touched him to wake him up, but something stopped me. I was suddenly afraid. Perhaps it was because he looked so innocent lying there with such perfect trust. Perhaps it was because he was so much smaller than me. My own body suddenly seemed gross and crushing, and the desire which was rising in me seemed monstrous. But above all, I was suddenly afraid. It was born in on me. But Joey is a boy. I saw suddenly the power in his thighs, in his arms, and in his loosely curled fist. The power and the promise and the mystery of that body made me suddenly afraid. That body suddenly seemed the black opening of a cavern in which I would be tortured till madness came, in which I would lose my manhood. Precisely, I wanted to know that mystery and feel that power and have that promise fulfilled through me. The sweat on my back grew cold. I was ashamed.
And that was James Baldwin reading in 1963 from his novel Giovanni's Room. And if you've turned into KPFK, you're listening to From the Vault live from the Central Library downtown. I'm your host, Brian DeShazer. And with me are Dr. Melvin L. Rogers and Nina Revor. Both are here to discuss Baldwin. Melvin, let me go to you first. You know, I'm still stunned at that reading, even after I've heard it so many times over the 20 years I was at in the archives. It's romantic, it's tender, and it's 1963. and the subject matter, tell us what you felt, I guess, is the right way to ask.
I mean, that's such a rich, I mean, although he reads it in 63, it's written in 56.
Right.
And it's just crazy, right?
So it won't even play in Peoria now.
No. So Nina said, a moment ago, and I think she's spot on, right, that Baldwin really is trying to get you to travel with him. He's trying to implot you in a story so you can see the inner workings of it and maybe get a glimpse into the demand that it places on you. Fiction is not just simply storytelling, right? Fiction is an attempt to get us to see something about the world we inhabit. It's great possibilities, and it's many limitations. So we have this scene between David, the protagonist, and this boy, Joey. It's a sexual scene. And what is striking about the scene is actually a piece that we didn't include. Hmm. So he says at the end, "I'm ashamed." But the next sentence that follows is that the very bed in its sweet untidiness testifies to vileness. That's what he says. Why does Baldwin speaking through David, as it were, or Baldwin attempting to get us to understand the interiority of David's mind, why does he say this? Right? He says it because he finds himself chasing some standard that he otherwise does not identify with, some standard that passes for manhood and masculinity. And what we come to discover is that in chasing it, this idea of manhood and masculinity, it both constrains and ultimately destroys what he had previously identified in that moment as his joy.
Yeah, that's the part that always gets me teared up. When he says joy, that does it for me.
Yeah. And in chasing the standard, he can't experience joy. And in fact, the result is, throughout the entire book, is that he comes to live an inauthentic life, a life without, per our earlier clip, a life without integrity.
Right. I wanted to share, I had originally edited that clip to actually end it on that word joy, because I just loved that ending, and we discussed it, and they wanted to lengthen it to have the resolve to where he became ashamed and disavowed that love. And I appreciate that contribution for us and our listeners out in KPFK land. So, Nina, you the writer, how hard it is...
We're both writers.
Okay. not the novelist. How hard is it to write a love scene like that?
Wow.
Boy, is that loaded?
Oh, man. It's
you've got 30 seconds.
I want to hear this.
You've got more than 30
seconds.
The
amount of emotion, you know, the array and the extremes and the kind of roller coaster that occurs in that one scene is quite profound, and that is very, very difficult. And I think that what you just finished with about the integrity is so important, because this is both about romantic love,
right,
but it's also about the inability to step fully into experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I should say one thing I didn't say earlier. When I discovered that James Baldwin, you know, it was college for me too, mm-hmm. not only could write about race and America so eloquently, but that his second book was this novel, and talk about, you know, not doing what is expected of you, right, after Go Tell It on the Mountain. That blew, and I was a, you know, 20-something gay kid who, again, didn't have a whole lot of models. And it just blew my mind. If it was difficult, you know, and not a given that you could grow up safely, not that it is today, but it certainly wasn't, you know, when I was a teenager or 20, I cannot imagine the courage and, yes, integrity it took in 1955 to publish this book. It's just it's unreal. So, but one point that Baldwin made about this, and I don't think he was just dissembling, I think there's truth to it, that he would say about this book, this is not a book or a story about, or strictly about, homosexual love. It's a story about what happens to someone when they're afraid to love anybody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that he speaks about over and over and over again, you know, throughout his life. The choice, the false choice between doing the safe thing, mm-hmm. the expected thing, or truly stepping into experience. And love is not just about romantic love and going to bed with someone, mm-hmm. but about accepting a person, a family, a people, you know, a country in its totality, and how difficult that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you mentioned fear, and in listening to that clip, you know, the moment he talks about being frightened of mm-hmm. that spark of new love and that new experience of the body, that's what really struck the chord with me. And again, it's that universality of what he's writing about that makes it last. We're not going to talk about all of Baldwin's books. There's no way that we have time in this evening and in this broadcast and even
we could stay.
Yeah, we could stay. And everybody's got the parking. So again, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, and we're really proud here on Live from the Vault to be here with you. And we have plenty of time, so we're just going to go to the next clip, and that gives us more time with the audience for question and answers later. But I'm really enjoying the conversation and what you're contributing to the conversation and deepening that conversation. So we're going to move on to another example of... Oh, wait a minute. Before we move on, I was going to say, like, that was sort of the moment where we could identify the queerness in James Baldwin. The next clips are going to be more political. Political is personal. But this was the moment where we actually talked about mm-hmm. his homosexuality, his openness in a time when clearly it was dangerous. And, you know, thank goodness for James Baldwin writing those books. All right, so let's move on now to another example of James Baldwin's powerful oration. With a moment in history that poured gasoline to the fire that Baldwin wrote about in his 1963 essay, The Fire This Time. Before we hit play, listen to how his voice is different from the last time that we heard in the last clip. It's not just that he's angry. He has deep rage. Listen to the way he delivers his thoughts with a rapid fire that he can hardly contain. This is after the murder of four children in Birmingham, delivered at the New York Community Church, September 25th, 1963, not even a year after he spoke at that same church about the artist's struggle for integrity.
I have to say some very reckless things tonight, and so I want to make it absolutely clear that I am talking for myself. I am not... I might be at other platforms and other occasions more or less representing this or that organization or this or that committee, but tonight I am talking to you as Jimmy Baldwin, who was born in Harlem 39 years ago, who has a certain responsibility to the people that produced him. That is all of you. And I'm speaking to you, if I may say so, not as an organizer, and not as a Negro leader, and not as a public figure, not as any of those things, but as one of the poets that you produced. We have to talk about economics tonight, and in some detail, we must talk about morals, and I think in some detail, and we must talk about something even more difficult to put one's finger on, which for the moment we will call morale. And the assumption on which I am speaking is this, that whether or not we like it, we have reached a point, black and white in this country, where all of the previous systems of communication, negotiation, accommodation have become unusable. To discuss the economics first. A few days ago, it was suggested by some of us, as forcefully as we knew how, that in order for the country to be unable to ignore and to forget the slaughter of 6 children in an American city, and in order to join the issue and bring the battle to where the battle really is, that is to say, to strike at the economic structure, that no one, black or white, should buy any presents for Christmas. I think that we should spell this out perhaps a little more precisely. I mean, and now I'm speaking for myself, that in this Christian nation, Christmas is mainly, as indeed are most churches, a commercial endeavor, having nothing whatever to do with the birth or the death of Christ. That if one begins to serve notice, ultimately on the banks, that we, the citizens of this country, do not consider that we have the right to celebrate Christmas this year, and that furthermore, we will use every weapon in our power to force this on the attention of the American Republic, which unluckily, I have to say, has its conscience mainly in its pocketbook. I believe that we will begin to see some notion of our potential power. Let me put it this way. Before this country was established, when the country was being established, and this apart from what one's textbooks say, and in contradistinction to the television myths about the building, the discovery of America, the people who came to America, as it turns out, were neither heroes, saints, nor pilgrims. They were simply people who couldn't make it where they were. And that is why they came.
Well, I think we have a lot to talk about with that one, don't we? So let me go to Nina, let's go to you first and just have a quick response, and we'll just bring in everybody into the pool, because there really is a lot to talk about that I don't think that we even planned last time we met last Thursday. So much has happened, so let's open the floor.
That's the these selections had been made some time ago, and to hear Baldwin say, to talk about morals, to talk about morale, that we're at a moment of low morale. The old methods of communication, negotiation, accommodation have become unusable. wow. Amazing. I think that I don't hear as much of a difference as you do. Hmm. And what I mean by that is that I don't want to mistake the earlier kind of modulation of his speech, of his tone, for a lack of rage. I think it is there always. I think it is there always. In the same way that I think what has happened over the last 2 years, especially with demonstrations, with Black Lives Matter, it's not that suddenly people got pissed in a way that they weren't before. It's that it became silence and acquiescence became impossible to continue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you hear happen in this clip a little bit.
I guess as a radio guy, I hear the phonetics rather than the underpinnings,
yeah,
which that's why the artists are here to tell us that.
It's a more urgent moment. When he talks about economics, I think about the Frederick Douglass quote of power concedes nothing mm-hmm. without a demand. And there is all of that, which I know that you're going to speak to a little bit. But I also think about that what happened after Birmingham, and I'm hopeful, this may be unrealistic, but I'm hopeful that there's also a conscience that is still awakeable. When people saw the images in Birmingham, of the fire hoses, of the dogs, of the little girl, of the bombing of the church, something shifted. And I'm hopeful that for all of the terror, for all of the sadness, for all of the despair, for all of the anger, that maybe there is a national awakening that is happening. I think about what happened last week and the fact that the incident with Philando Castile mm-hmm. was taped. And Diamond Reynolds caught that. And the level of horror by the broader country seemed a little bit different. And it shouldn't have been different. But it seemed a little bit different because people thought, oh, my God, how could that have happened? And so the optimist in me, and the optimist and the pessimist have been warring for the last week and a half, but the optimist in me hopes that in addition to pressing the power that has to be done, that there hopefully also may be some kind of beginning of awakening of conscience.
Melvin L. Rogers.
Yeah, I think Nina's right. So I think that the reason why Baldwin's tone changes, per Nina's point, has nothing to do actually with the presence or absence of rage. It has everything to do with the gravity of the moment. Right? You just had March on Washington in August of 63 for jobs and freedom. And then in September, 3 weeks maybe, you get the bombing of 16th, right? Street Baptist Church. And so part of what Baldwin is always doing, yes, it is him. It is his rage. But he's also the consummate Democrat in the following sense. He means to perform for us how we ought to perform in the face of tragedy. Right? And so he says, look, we got to do something. And of course, he makes the economic argument that we won't spend money, because this is where Americans' conscience seems to lie, right? That's where it seems to be located. And of course, we need only think of last year, November, at the University of Missouri, where the students were protesting in response to racially charged events and the sluggishness on the part of the president. They weren't getting a response. And then 30 players from the football team decided to protest a week before a game. They were poised to lose over $1 million. They announced that on Sunday. The president and chancellor resigned on Monday. But this is the thing that we have to be very clear about. Right? And this is what Baldwin is trying to get us to see. that although you may strike at the economic foundations of the society, it is only a jolt. It does not yet get you to the moment of moral transformation. It only prepares the way. And so the question, once again, is a question of choice. In the face of the jolt, are we prepared to hear the grievances that are emerging from the community? Or do we choose to ignore it?
Well, we certainly have more to discuss before we go to another clip, but I wanted to stop and take a moment to do our station identification. This is the radio part of the performance, just a moment, to give our listeners the chance to understand what they're listening to. This is From the Vault Live from the Mark Tabor Auditorium in the Downtown Central Library as part of the Los Angeles Library Foundation's Aloud series. From the Vault is broadcasting live for the first time since we began our series over 10 years ago. And we are live on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, and 99.FM Ridgecrest. So let's continue that conversation. Now we're back present. Back to the real world. Hello. So yes, more about that conversation. And, you know, again, choosing the clip about the economic impact of a strike or something that would impact like that the football players, I don't know how I chose that clip over another clip. You know, the after the murder of four children is a longer, I think it's a half hour or 40-minute speech, so you only heard 4 minutes of it. So again, I think my hearing the anger and the intensity of his oration in this recording sort of sits back in here. And again, these recordings can be accessed through the Pacifica Radio Archives, pacificaradioarchives.org. And here in the Los Angeles Library, Central Library, our archive staff, Sean Dallas and Jolene Beiser, are here with the table so you can explore the table of the other recordings of James Baldwin. I think we have 14 hours worth of James Baldwin in various years, being interviewed in speeches, debating Malcolm X, debating... that's okay. So more. So that's Pacifica Radio Archives. And you can also call them at 1-800-735-0230. All right, so let's see. We got to go. Oh, yeah, we have more time to talk about James Baldwin and After the Murder of Children and the relevancy. And again, I think nobody in this room did not hear from that last clip how relevant we heard you. That clip was and what he was really mm-hmm. saying. So, any more to talk about?
I'm a couple of things. That example is so great and current. And one of the things that was so moving about what happened in Missouri is that the black players led it, mm-hmm. but the other players joined.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of conversation about, you know, who's an ally? Can you be an ally? And I think that what they did in that moment was they stepped beyond being allies. And this became their issue too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's a move that we need to make as a country. Mm-hmm. That what is happening around police brutality, around economic inequality, around conditions of poverty is not an issue that is confined to one group of people.
Right.
This is all of our issue. This is a national issue. And that's mm-hmm. my thought. I wonder what you think
about
that.
No, Nina, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, because one of the things that's interesting is that when you look at least from the perspective of television, mm-hmm. The various airings of Black Lives Matter protests, one of the things I am, these days, I don't know anymore, but slightly encouraged by is the enormous diversity that seems to be on display, right? And that does suggest that there are reasons to believe that the possibility for transformation are there if we would only lay claim to it, right? I mean, one of the things that's extraordinary about Black Lives Matter in all of its diversity is that, you know, let's be honest, ethical and political transformation has never really lived in American politics. Ethical and political transformation has always lived in the bones of ordinary, everyday folks writing, and willing to put their bodies on the line. Right? And so what often happens is that American politics turns out to be a way of strangling our aspirational potentials, right? Aspirational potential that we clearly see on display when we look at Black Lives Matter or when we look at the example of Missouri, right? So the question is, once again, will we choose to lay claim to that aspirational potential, or will we choose to be strangled by the logic of American politics?
Anything else, Nina?
How do I follow that?
We can't have dead air on the radio, so we've got to move on to something if you don't have anything else to say. I also wanted to mention, he talked about immigration, where we came from.
Right.
And that's another, subject matter that, again, is so relevant. Everything that he talks about is right spot on in the news today. So the immigration question is in the Baldwin wheelhouse, if you will, in the recordings. And again, you can access them at the Pacifica Radio Archives. So now why don't we listen to our final recording, this one from here in Los Angeles, before we heard him in New York City. So here he's in the home of Marlon Brando, the actor Marlon Brando. I know, surprising, but I think you'll see a picture. And this is from March 16th, 1968, so time has passed. Here's Baldwin, and he's addressing men and women in the arts concerned with Vietnam, and he's introducing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I didn't know I was going to talk, really, I'm not going to talk very long. What can I say? The man who we are here to talk to, who will talk to us, that is Martin Luther King. I think it's very important to remember that this moment in 1968 is a kind of culmination of things that began in this country quite a long time ago, and specifically speaking, 1954, with the Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the schools, and in 1957, when Martin was thrown that ball in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to stand up because her feet hurt. Now, we've watched in this 11 years, in this 13 years, depending on the point of view, in this country, a terrible descent. What Rosa Parks was saying in Montgomery in 1956, and what those negroes were saying when they were marched for 389 days, the country did not want to hear and did not hear. And as time rolled on, and kids, including people like Stokely Carmichael, were being beaten with chains, thrown into jail, marching up and down those dusty highways, trying to change the conscience of this country, still nobody heard and nobody really cared. And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me. The principle John Donne talked about, when he said that any man's death diminishes me. But in this country, race and Christianity and power are so tied together in self-interest, what one takes is self-interest, then no one heard it. It's only now that people are beginning to suspect that something terrifying has happened, and with our consent, because we do know that we cannot fight a civil war, which is what this ferment is about, because I am your brother. I was born here. My father's blood is in this soil, and nothing will drive me from this country. It also belongs to me. You cannot fight a civil war and a global war, too, at the same time. And especially if both are predicated on the same principle. And I'm not now accusing the Americans of being wicked. and accusing us of having allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into a state of ignorance which allows us to forget that the peasant in Saigon and the peasant in Detroit are the same people. And what we don't know about the peasant in Saigon is what we don't know about Sambo here. And that has destroyed the American sense of reality. And I suppose what we're here to do tonight is begin to correct that. Are people who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, or happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children? Are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything? And I'm afraid that the people who claim to represent us in Washington these days, from the president on down, do believe that. And do believe, as they believe so long, that they have the right to tell me how to live. And aren't able to begin to suspect that other people, Sambo, for example, can teach us a great deal about how to live. That's all I have to say, really. I think that the most hopeful thing that is happening in this country now is that finally, cities being blown up, the isolation of black and white being more severe than it's ever been before, the great, great gap between all of us in this country, all over this country, and the fact that the government does not in any way whatever respond to what the people feel, is finally forcing all of us to realize that the life of this country is in our hands. It is not as it was thought of 10 years ago when Martin and those kids were marching up and down those highways, a Negro problem or a civil rights problem. What it is for all Americans now, and I mean this literally from the very bottom of my soul, it is now a matter of life or death. It's up to us. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly for your heartwarming applause.
And I wanted to end that with Dr. King's voice, just a minute. And that was the extemporaneous James Baldwin. As you heard him say, he wasn't planning to speak, and that was at the home of Marlon Brando, March 16th, 1968. If you've just tuned in to KPFK, you're listening to From the Vault. I'm your host, Brian DeShazer, and with me are Dr. Melvin L. Rogers and Nina Revor, who are here to continue discussing James Baldwin. Before we go to the audience for questions, let's have a final comment from both of you after hearing that clip. Again, 1968, and that was the last time Dr. Martin Luther King was here in Los Angeles before his assassination, April 4th, 1968.
Yeah, what I'm about to say might be a little blasphemous, but having King follow the heels of Baldwin, it is somewhat striking in part because Baldwin sounds much larger. Right? I mean, I probably shouldn't have said that, but he does. But he does. Right? I mean, what he says, you know, this is so rich, right? We've got Vietnam War. We got protests taking place all over the place.
He gives John this, Dunn.
John Dunn. He gives this in March of 68.
Right, March 16.
And then King is assassinated the next month. One of the things that I think is the two things at work, and I just want to sort of pull them apart. The first thing is the ways in which the United States has, dare I say, a love affair with dominating and if need be, extinguishing black and brown life, whether it's at home or whether it's abroad. And it emanates from the same principle. And the principle is, as Eddie Glaude says, right, that white lives are valued more than black and brown lives. That the decision to extend care and concern to some, mostly whites, is withheld from others. Right? The second bit that Baldwin tells us is that we actually believe that when the nation acts in our name, that it always fully and consistently embodies nobility, that it is acting honorably. We actually believe that a religion, let's just say Islam, which emerged, in the 7th century, really seemed to be formed out of a desire to destroy what passes for a modern conception of freedom that emerges in the 17th and 18th century. Really? Right? And so that part of what Baldwin here again is suggesting is that if we intend to belong, to be a part of a democratic society, then it rests on us to be far more clear-eyed about the government that often acts in our name than we often find ourselves, right? And that requires, of course, for us to let go of the pretense of innocence, right? To let go of the pretense that we are exceptional.
Right? There you go. I think we're going to take open the floor up for questions and answers. But I want to give, while the staff is looking for you who want to ask a question, Nina, I'm going to give you a minute. Or minute-ish.
It's like a debate.
Sorry.
1 minute. No, that's okay.
Sorry. Rebuttal.
No, that was very important.
No rebuttals, just additions.
Know, there are many things to respond to in that clip, but one of the things that was so moving to me is how he ties the peasant in Saigon to the peasant in Detroit. And particularly, obviously, Baldwin is speaking centrally from an African-American perspective, but he also ties himself and black people to the experiences of other people of color. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks in Notes of a Native Son about how disturbing it is that Japanese are described and demonized by the U.S. military and government. Mm-hmm. He talks in The Fire Next Time about the treatment of Mexicans, specifically, and Native Americans at the hands of the United States. And so I appreciate that. I also, the Dunn quote, any man's death diminishes me. Any man's death diminishes me. Mm-hmm. Again, being able to, how can we as a country start to feel like we are part of a collective whole? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, but that one line, any man's death diminishes me, this is how we can hold in our hearts grief for what happened to Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, and grief for what happened to the officers in Dallas. Those are not contradictions. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to, and I think that Baldwin wanted this, pushed for this. We need to be able to imagine and move towards a different kind of society. Whether it's possible that we ever get there, it's not clear. But it was so profound to hear him speak at the end of that and say, it's up to us. Mm-hmm. And to your earlier point, we cannot depend on the institutional structures, the politicians, to lead the way here. It's up to us. And by that us, I don't mean the artists and the academics and the it's up to us.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So do we have any questions from the audience? Yes, thank you. We have a beautiful audience here, ladies and gentlemen, in KPFK Radio Land. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to thank you guys for being here and opening the floor to questions. I think, you know, looking around this room, I am disappointed at the lack of youth in this room. No offense to all the lovely people in this room, but when we talk about who's going to be leading the future of changing what we know as this country, it's looking a little bleak in here. So when I say that to say the fight that I feel young people have now is to call white supremacy by its name, because reading Baldwin, to have not had that spoken on the stage affected me personally in a way, because he did call it what it is. And I think having friends that I know care about this struggle but are hiding behind these, you know, and tiptoeing around these things, I wanted your opinions around how we really address this issue if we're not really going to call it what it is. And speaking about a man who always called it what it was, how are we going to get there? Because sitting in this room and talking about it is nice, but I still don't feel like we've hit at the heart of it. And I'm curious to know how you feel. I know, you know, speaking from experience, it's not easy, but we're sick of it. We're sick and tired of being sick and tired. I mean, for me as a 28-year-old woman to say that is kind of crazy. So how do you feel about us not calling it what it is in forums like this and in other spaces?
Either of you want to take that?
I go too long. You go ahead.
You don't go too long.
No, I think I have no problem saying white supremacy.
Thank you.
This is, you know, right, so this is when, right, when I said white lives are valued more, right, than black and brown lives, right? And one of the things that's very important about the language of white supremacy, if in fact we are to use it, right, is that it is so, it's like putty in the sense of it molds, right? It can be molded to fit the various circumstances. So Jim Crow was one iteration of it, right? Slavery before that was one iteration of it. The carceral state is our modern version of it, right? The ways in which police extinguish black life is yet another version of it. And what ties them together is that in all instances, right, care and concern are clearly extended, right, to white folks. And it is withheld from black and brown folks. That, for me, is the essence of white supremacy. Right?
Yeah, I don't think either of us are afraid to call it what it is. And I think that, again, what you talked about in terms of the way that the U.S. conducts foreign policy, mm-hmm. The way that I talked earlier about not just police brutality, but also all of these systems and institutions and policies historically that have been created to keep people, you know, in certain communities together in poverty. Those are all systems and expressions of a system of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mean to talk about my own work, but my last book dealt very specifically with white supremacy in California and called it that. There was a white supremacist character. And you probably know this, I don't know if people do, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are more hate groups in the state of California than in any other state in the country. Okay, we think about the United States, California as being so diverse, which is true, but then this other thing is also true, and they are not unrelated. Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge for me in creating that character is I thought no one's going to believe this. No one's going to believe this person. And part of the progress in that book is a fairly decent but clueless set of people coming to realize this was true. I thought no one was going to believe this, and then Charleston happened. So yes, of course, that system of being in power is what undergirds everything we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to say, yeah, we're closed. We'll have one more question, and then we think we can close up. But I also wanted to say, you know, we're broadcasting this through KPFK, and it's going to go nationwide to our affiliate stations. So the partnership with the Aloud series and the Pacifica Radio Archives and KPFK is spreading this Baldwin's words and the discussion in an educational format, free speech radio. And that is hopefully some people, young people are listening now. They'll be broadcast on the college campuses. And hopefully that will encourage people to read more Baldwin, listen to more Baldwin, and because he certainly is relevant. One more question. And she's going to the top of the balcony. There you go. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering, in that portion right after that we heard about the Giovanni, him reading out off of the Giovanni book, right after that, David, the main character, shuns Joey, basically, right? And he shuns him, he mocks him eventually, not in that room, but later on. And then eventually, he, after acting so cruelly to him, eventually Joey leaves. And it's all out of his own shame of the situation. And Baldwin himself, time and time again, speaks with such passion about the effect that racism has on the Southern racist, or the effect that colonization has on the colonizer. And that's also such a beautiful thing about the way he writes, that he can incorporate that into his writing, and he's so aware of that. Could you both speak on that?
We got about 3 minutes before we close our program.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, how can you top what Baldwin... I mean, that's exactly right. And it's related to what I was saying. Any man's death diminishes me. We cannot... Another Baldwin quote, and I'm going to wrangle it, but he talks about how you cannot deny the humanity of someone else, of another person, without diminishing your own. And that's worth thinking about. Absolutely. That kind of hatred, of prejudice, of expressed bigotry twists the person, twists the people doing that as well. So I think, you know, again, I don't think anyone says it better than him.
Great. Well, I think we're to close to... Oh, you have another?
No. I think that should stand.
No, we're good. Okay. do we have time stand. For one more? Or no? Okay. Oh, no, you're going to sit down. Well, this has been a true pleasure, and that does it for this week's From the Vault, live from the Mark Taper Auditorium in the downtown Central Library. The Pacifica Radio Archives and I were proud to be a part of the Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and I'd like to thank Dr. Melvin L. Rogers and Nina Revor for being with us again. We'd like to thank Louise Steinman, Director of Cultural Programs, Jen Dees, Production Manager, and the Aloud staff, Maureen Moore and Sarah Charlton. Also, our Technical Director, Russell Pyle, thanks for getting the clips done perfectly, except I thought one was it, but it was me. It wasn't them. It was my fault. From the Vault is, who else do we thank? Frederico Garcia from KPFK, helping us with our broadcast, and Kiana Turner, thank you for your assistance. I'd like to shout out to the Pacifica Radio Archives staff, Mark Torres, senior producer of From the Vault, Mariana Berkovich, Sean Dellis, Jolene Beiser, and Edgar Toledo. From the Vault is produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and this is my final broadcast as host of and executive producer of the series that I co-founded with Christopher Sprinkle 11 years ago. I wish all the listeners and fans of From the Vault all the best, and thanks for listening and keeping our history alive. And thanks to KPFK and Pacifica Foundation for this opportunity to contribute and do preservation and access of the collection that is over 50,000 reel-to-reel tapes still needing to be digitized. And thank you very much, and hopefully we'll get those done with collaboration and help from everybody. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, everyone. Good night.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.